This podcast is proud to be part of the Blueberry Network. That's blueberrywithnoes.com.
Hey, this is John Lee Dumas of Entrepreneur on Fire, and you're listening to Transpersonal Radio with Angela Lynn Gibson. Remember, your thoughts upload your reality. Think wisely and always prepare to ignite.
Welcome to Transpersonal Radio.
Transpersonalradio.com.
Real talk for real life.
Inspiring podcasts.
Exploring personal empowerment and
transformation
through parapsychology, spirituality, and how your thoughts upload your reality. And now your host,
Angela
L. Gibson.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/transpersonalradio. Over 150,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player.
Hello, Transpersonal Radio listeners. Today we're going to delve into a topic that is very near, dear, and real in my world, as I'm sure it is in many of yours. I've survived the deaths of my mom, my son, my grandparents, close friends, and I've had quite a few of my own near-death experiences, as many of you know. As an intuitive medium, I work closely with clients making connections and exploring the transition from one state of being to another. A lot of people don't want to think about mortality, especially their own. And yet, death is as natural as life. Life and death are two sides of the same coin. My guest today is going to share with us some secrets of life and death. Today, we're going to talk about how to go from surviving to thriving, and how to avoid three pitfalls of grief that keep you stuck in the past. Grief, although a natural response to loss, can be disorienting, painful, and hard to manage. It can also be the doorway to a more powerful and purposeful life if you know how to enter it. In this interview, you'll learn practical strategies for allowing feelings without falling apart, how to have closure without losing connection, ways to relate to others so you can minimize conflict and get the support you need. And if you're struggling with emotions or feeling stuck or having difficulty with others, you may be missing some important tools in your grief toolbox. My guest today will reveal effective strategies for releasing feelings, letting go, and moving forward so you can have a life worth living. Dr. Michelle Petikolas has been working in the field of death and loss for over 15 years. She has a PhD in sociology with a minor in psychology and has studied with cutting-edge death pioneers Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, known for her five stages of grief, and Stephen Levine, director of the First Conscious Dying Project. Wanting to take the conversation a step further, Michelle produced the award-winning three-part documentary series, Secrets of Life and Death, featuring consciousness leader Ram Dass and Zen Hospice founder Frank Ostasevsky, who also appeared in Bill Moyer's four-part PBS series, On Our Own Terms. Since completing her films, Michelle has been invited to share them in hospitals, hospices, schools, and cancer organizations all over Northern California, including UCSF, John Muir, and JFK University. She has appeared on Voice America's Good Grief, Comcast's Newsmakers, and KPFA's Women's Magazine. Michelle's genius is igniting our curiosity and appreciation of death so we can live more conscious and fulfilling lives. Michelle, welcome, and thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you, Angela. I'm really, really looking forward to this.
I am as well. You know, this is a topic that is, again, it's something that people tend to want to avoid, and yet it's so important that we face these topics head on. And speaking of that, Michelle, let's start by going back to 1998. That was a really devastating time for you and a critical turning point in your life. I want to read an excerpt from your website because it's so powerful. You say, quote, "A spiritual explorer for many years, I returned to my family home full of glorious notions about the mystery and sacredness of dying. I was met with the blare of the radio, the smell of cat pee, family bickering, and paralyzing emotional demands. I tried talking to my mother about what she was going through as she succumbed to metastatic breast cancer. I soon realized that she was more interested in finishing up her projects than in exploring any inner journey of the spirit. My father, dying from Alzheimer's, was inaccessible, at least on a conscious level. I felt confused and regretful. I blamed it on American culture, my parents' upbringing, and my own lack of experience. My ignorance set me on a path to explore death, and my vehicle was the documentary film. End quote. So, Michelle, you experienced the death of both your parents just 6 months apart. Walk us through what happened, what you learned, and how you turned that experience into your life's purpose.
Okay, so I had just moved to California from New Jersey, maybe about 6 or 7 months before my father died. And I went back to be home for Christmas and ended up staying longer than I had originally planned because my father developed pneumonia and it was clear that he was going to be dying. Because my mother had decided that she was not going to let them give him antibiotics.
Mm.
He had a, you know, heroic methods to keep me alive. Mm-hmm. Although it wasn't clear exactly what he meant by that, but she felt, you know, that this was within his wishes. But it was really hard for her because the nursing home kept on calling her every time there was a change in the nurse's station because they were concerned about making sure that he got the care he needed, and they wanted to make sure that she hadn't changed her mind. But meanwhile, she felt like every time she had to say, no, I don't want you to give him antibiotics, she was sentencing him to death.
Mm.
So it was really, really disturbing for her.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, somebody, a friend of hers, told her about hospice and brought hospice in. They did an assessment, determined that he had less than 6 months to live, was put on hospice. That was the end of all the phone calls. And it was amazing that back in 1998, we knew absolutely nothing about hospice. And hospice, even today, doesn't get the attention, media attention, that it deserves or the people really need. People, when they hear hospice, they think, oh, we don't call hospice in until we're actually actively dying.
So for our listeners who don't really understand this process and they don't even know what hospice is, walk us through that a little bit and explain in a way that people can understand what is hospice, when do you use it, what is the purpose?
There was a woman in England who developed it to make the passage of people who were dying a more friendly, loving, compassionate experience.
Hmm.
And when it got started in the United States, it was originally volunteers, all volunteer. And then gradually they convinced Medicare to jump on the bandwagon and pay for it. And then it got a lot bigger, and now it's gotten really big. But initially the purpose was for the focus to be on quality of life or quality of dying, and to not get involved in any heroic methods to keep people alive. And the requirement was that you would die, that your prognosis was 6 months to live or less. Although many people have actually passed that deadline and continue to be on hospice because they're continuing to decline. And then some people graduate off of hospice because they enjoy the attention so much. But that actually helps them makes them feel better because a lot of people, it can be a very lonely process.
Sure.
It's a whole team that comes in. Doctor, social worker, nurses, healthcare aides. It's a fabulous support for families who are dealing with somebody who's in the last stages of their life.
Okay.
They have a chaplain. There's an opportunity to really explore the spiritual sides of what dying is about.
So when you, back in 1998, when you were facing the dire circumstances with your parents, and you lost both of them just 6 months apart, you, at that moment, you didn't have the kind of background you have now. So how did you handle it? What happened?
Well, I made a lot of mistakes. One of the mistakes was missing their death.
Mm.
So when my father was actually dying, I had been to see him a number of times before that, and I really wanted to be there when he died because I was curious. And because of my whole spiritual background, I thought it would be really, you know, an intense experience. But I got impatient, and death does not conform to our schedules. When I got the call from my mother that she thought he was dying that day, I didn't believe her. You know, I thought, oh, God, I can't. I just got here. I was about 2 hours away visiting my boyfriend at the time. So I didn't go back. And then later on, I got a call later on that he had actually died. And she said, do you want to come and see the body? And I said, see the body?
Oh, yes. Wow.
And that was, in retrospect, that was a mistake. I think it would have been good for me to have seen the body. And I missed both my father and my mother's deaths. And I never saw their bodies. So there's always that sense of them not quite being dead.
Right. You didn't have that closure that so many people seek.
There is something very, very closing about seeing the body without the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Something that happens viscerally on the physical level than when you touch it. My brother died a number of years later, and I did get to see his body, and it was just really amazing to be there and touch him and see that he was dead and get it.
So it lends credence to a lot of the funeral rituals and the different types of things that cultures engage in around the death process.
Well, a lot of those cultural practices are about being open to the experience as opposed to running away from it.
Exactly.
And clearly, I ran away. I didn't know any better, and I ran away.
Sure, and that's a normal response to a lot of people, you know. It's something that people sort of shudder at. They don't want to think about the Grim Reaper or death or ending or immortality, right?
Yep, that's right.
Michelle, in your film, The Heart of Grieving, you interviewed a woman who is talking about picking up the ashes of her husband who had been cremated. On the box that contained her husband's ashes were the words, temporary container. That was such a profound moment in the film for me because it really drives home yet again that our physical bodies are exactly that, temporary containers. In working so closely with so many grieving people, what's one of the most profound interactions that changed your life and your viewpoint on the process of mourning?
Well, interestingly enough, it was the experience of my mother's death. So there's a little story that goes along with this. I went back to help her finish up her business and to get ready, like literally to go to the funeral home and arrange for her cremation and arrange for her ashes to be put in a columbarium and the whole thing, saying goodbye to people that she did business with. And then it was emotionally too intense for me, and my back went out, and I went back to California. And then maybe two and a half weeks later, I get the call that she's actively dying. But I didn't want to go back. But there was a part of me that felt like I should go back. So I was not decisive. There was this ambivalence. Because I actually had a TV show that I was producing, and I had all these guests ready. So I didn't want to leave that. You know, I didn't want to change that.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided not to go back, but there was a part of me saying, well, if she's still alive, when that show's over, I'll go back. So every day I would get an email from my sister saying, well, oh, my mother by this time was in coma, and she'd stopped eating, and she'd stopped drinking any water. And so they said, well, it will only be a matter of a few days.
Hmm.
Each day I would get an email from my sister saying, well, she's still alive. And another day, and yeah, she's still alive. And then, you know, another day, and then she says, the hospice nurse is wondering why she's still alive.
Wow.
Then it dawned on me that I was literally holding her back, that my indecisiveness was holding her back. And I burst into tears, and I cried, and I called to the, you know, up to the heavens. I said, Mom, it's not about me. It's okay. You can die. She died that night.
And, you know, it's interesting, when I was listening to your story, Michelle, what immediately came to me was she didn't want you to suffer the same guilt you had about not being there for your dad when he died. So it's like she was holding on so you could come see her.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Well, and, you know, she may not have even had that consciously, or maybe she mm-hmm. was in spirit form and she was getting that, or maybe mm-hmm. it was just the lesson I needed to learn.
Mm-hmm.
But then afterwards, the emotions, I was not prepared in any way for the emotions. You're expecting these people to die, you mm-hmm. know? It was months that we knew that she was going to die, and yet what happens afterwards is stunning. And at the same time, there was a part of me in the back of my mind, in the midst of all this crying and everything, is this, oh, this is big. And this curiosity, what is this?
Mm-hmm.
And, hey, how come I didn't know about this?
Right.
Something's wrong here. So that was the turning point for me, was realizing how powerful death was and wanting to know more.
So it's interesting when you say it was stunning and you were saying, what is this and why haven't I known about it? And that goes back to sort of what you were talking about earlier with your upbringing. There weren't really any talks about death or that aspect of living.
Well, you know, I was brought up a Catholic, and so they have a whole sacrament around death. But by the time, my father wasn't a Catholic, and by the time my mother was dying, she had given up her faith, and I think all the family members gave it up at puberty. And so we didn't really have that container. So we just had the Western cultural container about death. And even though I had a spiritual practice, it wasn't Buddhism. Buddhism actually has an active approach to dying and teaches people about how to handle death. But I really didn't have any way. I didn't have any guidelines.
That's a great lead into what else I wanted to talk to you about, which is over the years, obviously, you've interviewed a lot of people. And the main focus for you, Michelle, was interviewing people who are open to, as you put it, the more mystical sides of dying.
That's right.
What about atheists and agnostics or others who don't have any type of spiritual belief structure or any belief in an afterlife? Can your films and your workshops and coaching help them?
They certainly can. And not everybody in my films believed in an afterlife. There are powerful messages in there about opening to the experience as a journey. This is your life right now. One of the women in the Caring for Dying film says that if you live each moment, as long as you're living, you're not dying.
Mm-hmm.
So to remain curious, what's going on? Oh, so that's how that feels. I remember a friend of mine who was dying of a really nasty cancer, and they had her on a lot of drugs because it was extremely painful. So her mind was really, really confused, because when you're on those drugs, you're like really stoned. You're really spaced out. And I remember saying at one time, it's like, oh, that's what that's like. There is this sense of her having this overview of, oh, that's what it's like not to be able to get your mind to work properly. So everything becomes curious. Well, that, you know, that's a way that you can deal with it. And the other thing I would invite people who are atheists and agnostics is to be curious about the people who do believe in an afterlife. And look at that, because, you know, what if there is something that exists after you die? It would be nice to, have a roadmap.
Absolutely.
To at least have some ideas of what it might be like.
Absolutely. And I think, again, it comes back to the same premise that you underscore repeatedly, is being open to the experience. And I think the same thing goes with, if you are agnostic or atheist, is actually being open to a possibility.
I want to tell you about one person that I actually accompanied through most of his last year of life. He had congestive heart failure, and he actually had a pacemaker, and he knew that he was going to die at any time. He never knew what was going to happen, and his biggest fear was that he would have a stroke, and he did not believe in an afterlife. And periodically, I would sort of suggest and ask him, well, you know, you've traveled a lot in your life. Wouldn't you like to have some sense of what the territory might be like? No. But he got interested in what it was like to be spiritual. And his rabbi told him that it was to have awe. And so we would sit out on his back porch overlooking the Bay Area, overlooking the bay, and watch the sunset. And one time he was really moving very, very slowly. And he was sitting in a chair, and for a long time we didn't even talk. And he was looking not at me, but next to me. And he said, you know, the interesting thing about this, of not moving a lot, is I see things, I notice things that I've never noticed before because of slowing down. Like that beautiful cloisonné vase with those beautiful red flowers and that turquoise kimono that's draped over the end of the couch. And I said, yeah, that's what it is, to stay curious, to keep on opening. What's happening now? What's happening?
Beautiful. That's beautiful. Michelle, let's talk about the huge pink elephant in the room. Fear. Why do people have so much fear around death? Why are people afraid to talk about mortality? Where's the fear coming from?
A lot of the fear comes from the unknown, from lack of control. Those are two big sources of fear. There are sources of fear just in the physical body. We're wired to want to control things as much as we can, because if we don't know what's going to happen, you know, some monster may come along and eat us up.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually wired into the body, is fear of the unknown. And we have a culture that literally represses or hides all information around death. And we put people in the hospitals, we put them in warehouses where we hide them away. It used to be in the past, they had a room, the parlor, which was literally for people who were dying and where to put the body after they died. And we don't do that anymore. So everything is concealed. So the more it's concealed, the more people are afraid because they don't know how to handle it. And a lot of people have moved away from their religious background, so they don't even have the guidance around that.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest fear comes from people who they're afraid of that annihilation, of ceasing to exist.
Oh, yes.
I mean, that's a really hard thing to fathom, is how is that that I'm no longer going to be around anymore?
Yes. The fear of loss of identity and personality.
Or consciousness.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's hard. That's hard to wrap your brain around.
Certainly. I can understand. I have a little bit of a different viewpoint. I used to have that. I was agnostic for a short period of time, even atheist. That's a whole different story. But I can tell you, you know, I went into the hard sciences purposely to get away from all the, you know, quote-unquote woo-woo stuff or religious or spirituality or any of that stuff. And I was hardcore in the sciences, and I have to tell you that I have had way too many experiences over my lifetime that have supported reincarnation and afterlife, and that consciousness actually does survive the demise of the physical body. It's incredible.
It is. And in fact, there is a lot of data out there. A lot. It's just that the scientific community refuses to look at any of it. But there's just amazing stuff that cannot be explained any way else, but that there's consciousness that exists separate from the body.
Absolutely. And you talk about being in awe and being curious and having excitement. I'm doing that right now because I am seeing an increased interest in research. You know, IANS, the International Association of Near-Death Studies, we have IONS, we have several different groups of scientists who are looking at the survival of consciousness after death and really starting to take it seriously. And that's so exciting for me.
Yes, for me as well. And you know, like you, I also have that very scientific side of myself. So
absolutely.
I love it when, you know, we hear from the scientists and they say, you know, there's absolutely no way that this could have any explanation. Mm-hmm. And the most amazing things are the people who come back to life. And that there is no way that they could have come back to life. It's like impossible.
Absolutely.
There is no scientific explanation for it. And they come back to life because, hell, it's not time for them to die yet.
Exactly. And I've had a couple of those personally. And I've known people who've gone through that. So, you know, there's a lot to this story. A lot more than we give ourselves credit for. And so that's, you know, I really appreciate what you're doing, Michelle, to bring a lot of this to the forefront and to stop hiding all this. Really start looking at it. We know historically rituals and ceremonies around death and stories about the afterlife have been around since ancient times. Some of the most elaborate and well-known, of course, are those of the Egyptians. And Latino culture celebrates El Día de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead. Hindus have a sacred practice in preparing and cremating the bodies of the deceased. Tell us about the Native American folktale, Old Man, Old Woman, and your film, The Origin of Death.
Well, this is a Siskiyou folktale, and most Native Americans, in fact, most spiritual cultures, have some explanation for the origin of life. The tale of Old Man, Old Woman is about the origin of life, but at the same time also the origin of death. Old man and old woman kind of go back, bicker, as as men and women sometimes do. And old woman says to old man, he says he wants to have the first say. She says, that's fine, as long as I have the last say.
Yeah.
So, you know, they bicker over how men will get food and how different things take place in living. And then it comes to death, and old man says, well, I think we should throw a buffalo chip into the water, and if it floats, then people will be reborn and live forever. And old woman says, no, I think we should use a rock. And if the rock floats, people will live forever. If a rock sinks, well, then they'll die. And in this way, there will be, you know, more room for new people, and the people will live their lives more consciously. But then the story continues, and old woman actually has a baby, and she loves this child very much. And then one long, cold winter, this child becomes sick and dies. And then she goes back to old man. She, you know, mournfully and grieving, you know, just feeling horrible. She says, I want to have another say about death. And old man says, no, you had the last say.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, on a conscious or intellectual level, we know that there's a lot of goodness about the fact that we have a limited lifespan. It makes us treat our lives more carefully. That is, if we have a consciousness about it, and
exactly.
That's part of my job.
Exactly, yes.
But also that it makes room, that there's this clearing out, there's this always this change and room for other people.
Exactly, and it is the natural order of things.
However, when it comes to you and when it's the person that's most near and dear to your life, it's another story.
Exactly.
And it's very difficult. Then suddenly it's like, wait a minute.
Exactly.
I want to change that rule.
Right. Rules apply to everyone else but me.
Yeah.
As we've been discussing, Michelle, we know that we have cultures. United States is one of them. Probably, I guess we could say a lot of Western culture. We have cultures who suppress or ignore the very idea of death. From your viewpoint as a sociologist and a grief expert, what are the consequences of the lack of cultural dialogue about death?
Well, one of the consequences is that we try and keep people alive long past their expiration point, and that we expose them to way more suffering than is necessary in the final stages of their lives. And that they actually aren't able to do the emotional, psychological, spiritual preparation that they really should be doing before they die. So that's one of the biggest consequences, is the pain and suffering, and that's not even mentioning the expenditure of money and resources.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But that people actually, the saddest thing is that they don't get to prepare.
So it's almost an excuse to keep ignoring. It's a positive feedback loop.
Well, I don't know if it's positive, but it definitely is a feedback loop.
Sorry, I'm using that in a scientific term where one thing reinforces another thing, and it just keeps going.
And as long as people don't know about death, or they don't know what the options are because they're so busy trying to keep their heads in the sand and not pay attention to it, then they get caught up in that whole medical pathway, and it's very hard to pull out because there's pressure to follow the routine that's set out. It's in the hospital and doctor's interest for you to stay in their system. Although, you know, some doctors, and there is change, there has been a start of change in that where, well, it has to because we got so many baby boomers heading towards middle age and dying, it's going to collapse the system if they don't change it. But for a very long time, the way in which money, the hospitals are reimbursed for their expenses is based upon, treatment. They don't get any money for helping you die. They only get money for treating you.
So they have a monetary incentive to drag the process
beyond.
Well,
Yeah, I mean, and that's understandable. It's an organization, and it has its needs, and it's got these beds. And so there is a way in which the whole structure encourages that. And it's difficult to break that until you know, somewhere along the line you break that. You start to develop some consciousness around that. There was a doctor, I don't know that I can pronounce his name, Atwal Gawande. He wrote an article from his own experience of helping, you know, caring about his patients and then being afraid to tell them that they were dying because he was afraid of taking away their hope, but then seeing the consequences of that. So a lot of this comes from when you get down to the doctors from a real place of caring and not wanting to destroy hope.
Yes, and that's so important because that is such a fine line. You have to allow space for hope so that there is space for healing if that's meant for that person's path. You don't want to destroy that prematurely.
That's right. That's right. But it would be so different if we had that conversation about death way, way ahead of time before we were even dying so that we knew that we had options.
Exactly. Exactly. And speaking of that, you know, I've been around people who simply pretend death doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been around those who are fascinated by or even somewhat obsessed with death. What advice do you have for approaching death in a more balanced, measured, healthier manner?
As I said before, to be curious, it depends on whether you're talking about people who are actively dying or have gotten a terminal diagnosis, or they've been diagnosed with cancer, and even though it may not be terminal, it certainly is death's calling card. Then there are certain things that those people should do or might want to do to help prepare. But then none of us know when we're going to die, and any of us could be taken out in the blink of an eye. So
exactly.
It's good to actually do this anytime, however old you are. So there are a number of things that I would recommend. The first being actually thinking about how you want to die. We think that we don't have any choice. We don't think about it. And so we sort of leave it up to chance or to the medical establishment rather than saying, well, how would I want to die? And some people, when asked that question, will say flippantly, oh, I want to die in my sleep. But if you actually ask them to think about that question and you invite them into greater dialogue around death, many people change that to wanting to be surrounded by their family and finishing up any last-minute business with their families, dealing with stuff like forgiveness and saying last things to precious people about loving them and being grateful for their being in their lives. So that's part of it, too, is finishing up the emotional part. And then there's another part, which is when you know that you sort of have a sense of an expiration date, is seeing your life as a whole, actually doing a life review and seeing how you have arrived at where you are and acknowledging, having that acknowledgement that it was a good life. Or if it wasn't, to come to terms with that and self-acceptance, whatever it was.
So over decades, I've done what seems like endless research on the death process and end-of-life preparations for loss of the physical body. I recently found the following quote. At the end of life, people aren't usually looking for new answers to the age-old question of what happens after we die. Instead, they think about the life they have lived and what they have known in the past. In your research and experience, do you find that to be an accurate assessment? Is that kind of what you were just describing?
I think that there is a need for doing that as part of the process of dying. If the person who is dying does not have a way of understanding the possibilities of life after death, if that is not real to them, then that's the choice they have. That's the only choice. Well, no, it isn't the only choice. The other choice is that they can make each moment of the rest of their lives meaningful to them. And that could involve having conversations with family members or maybe even just sitting out in the garden and enjoying the sky and the sound of the birds. It is worthwhile, though, to consider what happens after we die. And if you have a belief system that enables you to look at that, to prepare yourself, the biggest and most important preparation would be learning to meditate. and to be able to quiet the mind and the body to prepare yourself in that way. It makes everything easier when you can do that.
I agree. Meditation is a valuable tool. Michelle, do you personally believe in reincarnation?
Well, I believe in an afterlife, and from the readings that I've been doing, which I'm telling you, I resisted reading for a while because it felt like a really slippery slope. But I've been reading, you know, I've read a lot of people who have written books about near-death experience. And I've been reading this psychic medium channeler who has interviewed people on the other side. Mm. Who asks, and he asks people what it's like on the other side. And he tries to be very scientific and